Hi, this is Newt. I am currently staying at home in Rome. To bring you this episode this week, I'm recording from my home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. On this episode of Newt's World, this episode is the fifth in a series of episodes we're presenting about COVID-19 healthcare breakthroughs. We're looking at treatments for COVID-19 that will help improve patient outcomes or stop the virus from spreading. Vaccine development for COVID-19 is underway across the world. Multiple pharmaceutical companies are working on developing a vaccine they hope to release as soon as 2021. My guest today is currently working with Halovax, LLC, a special purpose subsidiary of Voltron Therapeutics, Inc., to develop a self-assembling vaccine to protect patients at risk of COVID-19 infections. The vaccine is being designed specifically in response to the pandemic, and with safety as the key component, so as not to attack the immune system when administered. The self-assembling vaccine is also being designed to be highly adaptable, allowing for seamless modifications in the face of potential genetic drift or future coronaviruses. We'll discuss this revolutionary vaccine research and other vaccines and studies that are in development for COVID-19. Dr. Mark Poznanski is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, an attending physician in infectious diseases medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and director of the Vaccine and Immunotherapy Center. His clinical subspecialization includes the treatment of infection in immune-compromised patients. Let me just start by, how did you get to here?
It's a very interesting question because it's sort of cyclical. I wanted to be a doctor from about the age of 8. My mother's a doctor. I come from a line of doctors. So age of 8, I wanted to become a doctor. And interestingly, when I was about 11, I realized that there were infectious diseases. So I had two brothers at that time. And when they got something, I realized I would get it shortly thereafter. And the pinnacle of that story was that my parents came home one day after school and they found that I'd locked my brothers in a room because they were developing chicken pox. So at the age of 11, I had already been aware of the idea of quarantine. Of course, I got chicken pox anyway, but because my parents let them out of the room so they could have dinner. From there, obviously, I went to medical school, but I think what's pertinent to COVID-19 is that I emerged as a young medical student, an intern, at the very beginning of the HIV pandemic at Edinburgh University Medical School. So in Edinburgh, the story is quite dramatic. All 2,000 IV drug users in Edinburgh seroconverted in the space of about 6 months. So they all got HIV because there were no needle banks or anything like that, so they were all sharing needles.
Was that about 1983?
Exactly, 1983 to 1986. I was in my final years of medical school and then becoming an intern. You're absolutely right on the year. And it just was all-encompassing. You can imagine being an intern at the beginning of that great pandemic. I find myself reflecting back to that time and how we dealt with it and the lessons of that. Now with COVID-19, which actually in terms of scale is much, much greater because the at-risk population is the entire global population as far as we know. We became aware, obviously, HIV is a sexually transmitted disease. There were risk behaviors, IV drug use and so forth. So now, 40 years later, we are facing the real pandemic where the whole population is vulnerable and calls for an even greater level of targeted scientific and medical activity to contain this enormous threat, both medically, socially, economically, spiritually, you name it.
What makes COVID-19 a greater threat than the other pandemics of the last 40 years?
I would say what appears to be an entirely naive, and I'm using the word immune naive population globally. So it's a virus that no one has ever seen up until what we think may have been December of last year. So the whole global human population is at risk of infection. That's number one. Number two is, as was the case with HIV, we're just beginning to learn about the disease that it causes. In other words, at first we thought, well, maybe it's like a serious version of flu. Maybe it's like SARS was. But it turns out to have its own issues of how it presents. And you're probably following the news like I am, and I'm reading medical literature on the pediatric cases of this Kawasaki vasculitis disease, the way that it presents in children, the way that it presents in adults, the different organs that it affects in adults, the skin, the gut, the brain, the immune system itself, obviously the lungs, the heart, the kidney. It's not just that the whole population of the world is vulnerable, but that within that population, there are proportions of that population that are vulnerable to all these different hits on their particular organ systems. I do have a little bit of a skewed view, because when we're up working in the hospital, we're sort of the infectious disease attending, following patients in the ICU. So we do see the most severely ill patients. But what we're seeing are patients who are severely ill and multiple organ systems in their body have been damaged. That is a serious pandemic condition. I just don't want to be alarmist to the extent that obviously the vast majority of people actually recover. But what it's leaving as a burden for the healthcare system is obviously the most seriously ill patients, which is much more significant than HIV was because of the numbers that we're dealing with. The pandemic curve has been flattened in Massachusetts, but we have 300 or thereabouts patients with moderate or severe disease in the hospital at this very moment. That's a lot of patients, a lot of beds in a hospital that has about 1,000 total beds. We never saw that with HIV. That scale of hospital occupancy was never seen with HIV.
You have a virus which is probably in some ways still evolving in its relationship with humans, because in a sense, if it's new to us, we're new to it.
Yes.
And therefore, we don't quite know how many permutations there are going to be of how it affects us.
Correct.
Does it look like most of the people who do recover are developing some kind of immunity, or do we not know enough yet?
Well, I think the thing is, it's like the phrase, some kind of immunity. So we can detect that they have antibodies to the virus. The question is, because the disease is new, would they get the disease again if they're challenged? I don't think we yet know that case. I haven't seen cases of patients who have demonstrably had dual infection. You know, they were infected early on in the pandemic and then they're infected again and actually become ill. I do go with Dr. Anthony Fauci's point that it would be a very unusual virus. It fails to evoke a protective immune response or proper, you know, immunity in humans. Humans have an amazing immune system that is obviously kept the species alive and thriving for millions of years and has not been extinguished by a pandemic yet. So the idea that somehow from that regard, COVID would be completely different, I agree with Dr. Fauci. I think it would be highly unlikely, but the science is still out there that needs to be done to prove it. And some of that is time. We just need to learn more. It's not something we can learn immediately because the pandemic has to play out longer for us to understand that.
I guess other than the Black Death in the 17th century, which may have killed off a third of Europe, even the Spanish flu, which killed a lot of people, more than the First World War, in terms of the total species, had a relatively smaller impact than the kind of disaster that I think we're kind of braced for.
Well, I mean, the history of pandemics like that is obviously people left the cities to go to the countryside. And that was when there was mostly a rural economy. Now, the average city size is millions of people, and most of the productivity is occurring in the cities.
Elias Zerhouni, when he was the head of NIH, he'd been born in Algeria and had a unique view of the world. And I remember working with him in one meeting, and he said, you now have four-star hotels one block away from a slum in which people have walked in from the jungle.
Right.
The number of things that are going to cross over, that are going to enter the sort of first world by jet aircraft, is almost beyond imagining and is virtually guaranteed. And in a sense, that's what we're living through. A bad virus out of southern China now got me spending 9 weeks in a house in Rome. Italians try to cope with this. And you're going through the same thing in New England.
I'm so glad you make that point, because I think that can sometimes be lost, that let's take Wuhan. Before industrialization, it might have been a little city, mostly agrarian and so forth. It expands to a city state, 10 to 15 million, with one of these wild animal grocery markets in it. The scope of disease transfer between animals and a vast human population is now massive. And I do want to say, to the great credit of the US Department of Defense, they were monitoring this over a decade ago and looking at virus in those animals and looking at those ones that could potentially cross over to the humans. It was a pandemic waiting to happen.
There's an amazing article from 2007 in which four Chinese researchers said, people keep eating this particular bat from southern China, and this bat clearly is carrying this particular virus. And they said, sooner or later, this is going to be a disaster. Now, this is 13 years ago. But the other part of it is, this is not the last one. And we need to be thinking about building a public health system that can assume that every 5 or 10 years for the foreseeable future, something will come out of somewhere. And it will be new and different, and we'll have to be able to mobilize and deal with it. And that's been our experience for the last 20 or 25 years now. We've had considerable growth in the number of interesting things that come out of Mother Nature and decide to come visit us. But now, tell me, there's a huge amount of hope being placed on this whole notion of getting to a vaccine. What's your sense of that? How likely is it that we will develop a vaccine for COVID-19 in a reasonable period of time?
Number one, the human race has certain advantages in this setting. And one of it is diversity of thinking, diversity of ideas. The fact that I think at the last count, there are over 100 vaccine platforms going after COVID-19 is a great human response. There's no reason to, at this point as a human, to say, I'm banking on this one, I'm banking on that one. It's just that human diverse thought in a scientific setting is one of our great opportunity builders. And in this context, gives us multiple shots on goal. So I think that it's likely, I can't say it's very likely, because we don't know enough about the disease or the immune response yet to it. Like we've started off talking about, what is a protective immune response? Since we don't quite yet know what that is, we don't know what we're building the vaccine to do. However, because we've got over 100 shots on goal, we may just hit on the one that counts. And we have to remember that a lot of great vaccine development, all the way back to smallpox, and even before that, President George Washington using smallpox lesions to vaccinate his own army, was very successful in its own right. So we may be able to get to a vaccine without knowing everything about the immunology of the virus. So I think it's likely, but there are limitations. The likeliness is bred out of the diversity of platforms, and the fact that in vaccine history, we have hit it lucky without even potentially sometimes, like Jenner did, without even knowing immunology or virology, he came up with the smallpox vaccine. So that makes it likely, but I can't say more than that at this point, Newt. I just think that we just have to rely on the diversity of science to prove one way or another that this is going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months.
If we're talking about, in a best case, 12 to 18 months, how do we cope with both the social isolation and the economic decay over that long a period of time?
The other play that humans have developed is tremendous global communication. So we have to learn from each other, from New Zealand, from Israel, from South Korea, countries that have worked out systems to get their people back to work. One of the things from Israel is that I think they have recognized that children going back to school is important because that frees up parents being able to go back to work. You can't have parents going back to work unless you have kids going back to school. And I could, at least following the news on the Times of Israel and so forth, I can see that they're slowly bringing the schools back first. I guess my point to you is, I'm an expert in infectious diseases, but I'm not an expert in sort of population control and bringing back the economy. But I know that there are models being developed all over the world that are looking successful that we should learn from. And I also think that one could assemble, like these countries are, database systems based on maybe not perfect, but good enough immunology testing. I wrote an op-ed in The Hill about this. There are good enough systems that could help us get back to work. It just suddenly struck me. I go to work every day. I work in a hospital. I have to attest to my symptoms. I have to wash my hands, wear gloves when appropriate, mask, all of the stuff you can imagine. And I go to work every day. So there's a less than perfect system. I don't have a blood test every day to do that. But there's a system that keeps the hospital working. And I think for each company and for each public service, there are systems that can be put in place that make that possible. And I just think that needs to come into play and start to be deployed both at federal and state levels to make this happen.
Now, apparently there's an article that's come out in the last couple of days from China, indicating that there may be as many as 30 different strains of this particular virus, which I would think is fairly unusual to have that rate of mutation or that rate of evolution. Do you sense you're dealing with more than one core kind of virus when you look at the patients that you're dealing with?
Not yet. Other than we see mild, moderate, and severe disease, I don't think that's yet been worked out. However, there's a beautiful article published by Los Alamos and Sheffield University in the UK, which are tremendous genetic experts looking at actually two dominant strains of the virus. There was the original founder strain, and then there was a mutation, and there's a secondary strain. Interestingly, the secondary strain dominates in England compared to other countries where there might be a mix of the first strain and the second. I haven't read the article about 30 different variants. I think the important thing scientifically is the one that they're looking at in this Sheffield Los Alamos study is the predominant strains, and the mutation does affect a major binding site that antibodies go after in the virus. There are mutations a virus can have which make no difference to either its immunology or the way it causes disease. And there are others like this one that's interesting that may actually affect how your immune system reacts to it. That's the most up-to-date article, I think, published, or at least in preprint version this week, but beautifully written, beautifully studied by experts with regards to two variants. But there's no link in that study, Newt, to any difference in terms of how the disease presents. They did look at it and there was no difference.
So even though the virus itself may have some unique different characteristics, they're irrelevant in terms of the impact on humans.
Exactly. Yes, they may be irrelevant the way the human sees it.
The study I was citing was by Professor Li Lanhuan and colleagues from Zhejiang University in China, where they're suggesting it has mutated into 30 different variants, which would surprise me a little bit. In the period when you were in Edinburgh worrying about HIV/AIDS, I represented the Center for Disease Control in Congress. And I would go regularly. I really got to know Fauci back then. And I was very concerned about, because back then, of course, it was a devastating disease for which we had no good therapies. I worried about its potential for evolving, but the people at CDC were pretty confident that that particular problem is so complex that it's pretty well locked into being what it is. It doesn't have a fluidity that it can evolve into. The nightmare is when you finally figure out a particular virus, and then you turn around and the virus shifts in a way that we can't deal with. I think that's when it becomes a real challenge. There are specific vaccines being developed in Boston. Voltron Therapeutics is partnering with Mass General, and they have hopes that they're going to enter animal testing. These kind of partnerships where you have the drive and the energy of the private sector, but you also have the knowledge and the capabilities of the public sector collaborating together, they're really sort of the model of the future, aren't they, for complex issues?
Newt, it's so important, this point. Academics don't make medical products. Companies do. In the partnership we have around building a COVID-19 vaccine, which the center that I direct, Vaccine Immunotherapy Center, is developing, we're calling it HaloVax. It established a partnership with a company a few weeks before the pandemic, and that was purely by chance. And then 2 weeks after the pandemic started, the company moved to raise money to get our vaccine, HaloVax. This company is called Voltron Therapeutics, in collaboration with Hoth Therapeutics, raised the money to get our vaccine built and tested in animals. And that was all in the space of 2 to 4 weeks, effectively.
Wow.
And I think the biggest thing that happens, I'll just tell you, is that academics build things, and they build them for several years, and then they want to partner with industry. And then there are all sorts of Groundhog Day issues of having to go back to the drawing board and did it work. What we've learned at our center is to partner with industry directly and accelerate that process by which a product is generated and tested in an industrial manner, which is so different from testing something in an academic manner. And I think that could be one of the great kind of readouts from this, is that academia adapted to be more industry-like or more friendly to partnering with industry than ever before. Not that it hasn't been on that path, but it's needed more than ever because of the urgency of needing products now as opposed to in 5 years.
I've been very impressed by the scale of innovation, both in therapies and in vaccines and in testing. I mean, the number of different players who've come into the game and the speed and intensity with which they're operating, I think is a pretty good tribute to the way our system operates and really rising to the challenge. And I suspect by late summer, our production capabilities will be such that large parts of the third world will be relying on American capabilities to deal with all this.
The other big attribute is a free society in which all constructive ideas are allowed to flourish in a scientific manner. And you're all power to our US system that allows that to happen and the support for it. It's a key thing for our survival to maintain that type of freedom of thought and freedom of idea development and product development that happens in the US. This is about pandemic preparedness well into the rest of this century and possibly beyond.
But I want to thank you. I think this has been very, very helpful. And I think that our audience will find it very educational and very informative.
I think information is power, and I really am grateful to have this opportunity to speak to you about this issue.
Thank you to my guest, Dr. Mark Poznanski. You can read more about the development of a vaccine for COVID-19 on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Petlin. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, our China and COVID-19 series continues with part 3. On April 21st, 2020, Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt filed a lawsuit against the Chinese government for COVID-19. He leads a growing chorus of holding China accountable for the devastation the virus has caused. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.